Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the additional sanctions imposed on Vladimir Putin's bank and his cronies, and speak with Kevin Platt, a professor of Slavic languages and literatures at the University of Pennsylvania, who has an article at the Huffington Post, Russia's Powerful Media Bubble. We will discuss how Putin has created an alternative universe that Russians inhabit and assess what impact Kremlin propaganda is having on Russians in eastern Ukraine and Russian minorities in the Baltic states of the former Soviet Union, what Russia calls the near abroad. Then we'll examine the growing movement for public and community banks like the Bank of North Dakota that was founded a century ago in the last Gilded Age as an alternative to plutocratic control of banking. Gwendolyn Hall-Smith, the executive director of the Public Banking Institute and the co-founder of Vermonters for a New Economy, joins us to discuss a bill in the Vermont Senate that would establish a public state bank in Vermont out of an existing state institution that has enormous grassroots support but is being subjected to intense lobbying from the powerful banking industry who have dominated the hearings. Then finally, we will look into the giant $45 billion Time Warner Comcast merger that the CEO of Time Warner Cable, Robert Rob Marcus, describes as a dream combination, which it certainly is for him, since he will receive an $80 million golden parachute for losing a job he has only held for 3 months. John Simpson, a veteran journalist and consumer rights advocate with Consumer Watchdog, joins us to discuss how executives who negotiate mergers are able to reward themselves so lavishly and whether this dream combination that will create a monstrous cable TV and internet monopoly will have the lobbying muscle to buy off antitrust regulators and the informational power to blunt public resistance to a corporate monopoly that is free to charge what they like for delivering increasingly lousy service. And joining us now is Kevin Platt, who's a professor of Slavic languages and literatures and graduate chair of the Comparative Literature Program at the University of Pennsylvania. His books include Terror and Greatness, Ivan and Peter as Russian Myths, and History in a Grotesque Key, Russian Literature and the Idea of Revolution. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kevin Platt.
Thanks. Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
And you have an article at the Huffington Post, Russia's Powerful Media Bubble. And it is so powerful, of course, that the Russian people are largely in an alternative universe, although it was interesting to read in the New York Times on Thursday an op-ed by Alexei Navalny, who is the Russian dissident under house arrest who ran for mayor of Moscow recently, one of the more prominent critics of Putin. He suggested in his article that the U.S. should target its sanctions on Putin's cronies and the Kremlin mafia. And he listed a bunch of people, Timoshenko, the Rotenberg brothers, Arkady and Boris, Yuri Kovalchuk, Putin's banker, Vladimir Akunin, president of the Russian Railways, and he mentioned the oligarchs, Abramovich and Usmanov, and the two heads of Rosneft and Gazprom. None of those last four were sanctioned, but the earlier names that I read were, along with a lot of others, going back to Putin's cronies from St. Petersburg, and most importantly, of course, the Rossiya Bank in St. Petersburg, which is Putin's own bank. So do you think this is going to bite?
Well, I think it's going to make people uncomfortable, but I'm certainly not an economic analyst or an economic historian. It's hard for me to make an assessment of what the actual impact is going to be for these people. I don't even understand personally what it's like to be a multi-billionaire. Like, how much do you care if, you know, one or two of your billions are cut off for a short while? But I think it speaks too to the very complexity of the situation with regard to economic sanctions against Russia. All of these guys are huge oligarchs who created their wealth through fleecing the Russian people by taking control of the privatization process or through raiding the former generation of oligarchs from the 90s who took control of the privatization process. They have immense wealth, but lots of that wealth, too, is invested in the West, is active in Western stock markets. I just don't quite understand what the effect on American markets is going to be, what the effect on their position in American economic life or Western economic life is going to be. I think it's a really complicated situation.
But the other prominent dissident, the chess master Kasparov, has said that Putin's afraid of banks, not tanks. Would you agree with that?
I think it's true, but I mean, once again, I'm not an economic analyst. I can't really. I'm not the best authority to talk on these issues. But the basic fact is that Western Europe is dependent on Russian gas. There's no way that anyone's going to cut those, you know, gas lines in a quick way. There is the possibility of, I know, making American strategic reserves available, making American export available of gas to Europe. But that all takes time to set up terminals, to set up new methods of distribution. And in the end, I think that it can actually make up for the, you know, Russian supply in totality. So there's a kind of basic energy dependence between the West and Russia, which can't actually be addressed through sanctions. Russia knows that. They know that the West needs Russia as much as Russia needs the West in order to maintain the sort of basic economic structure of the world. So I think there's a limit to what can be done with economic sanctions. But we'll see. Maybe it will have an effect. I wonder how quickly sanctions such as this would actually have an effect on the Russian people, because in the end, what's driving the entire matrix, I think, is the expectation on the part of Putin and his administration that, you know, a small victorious war, that, you know, nationalist frenzy, that a sense of being under attack from the West and therefore that the Russian people have to come together is going to raise his poll ratings and give him the popularity that he was beginning to lose already 2009 forward, then 2011, 2012, the protest movement. You know, Putin was on edge. The real question, I think, is will economic sanctions have an effect on the daily life of Russian people to the extent that they understand that they need to be part of an interconnected world? And I have no idea how long that has to simmer until there's actually a felt discomfort.
Again, I'm speaking with Kevin Platt. He's a professor of Slavic languages and literatures and a graduate chair of the Comparative Literature Program at the University of Pennsylvania. His books include Terror and Greatness, Ivan and Peter as Russian Myths, and History in a Grotesque Key, Russian Literature and the Idea of Revolution. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, Russia's Powerful Media Bubble. So let's turn to your expertise on Russian language, culture, and media, Kevin, and talk about your article, Russia's Powerful Media Bubble, which has enabled, which is certainly Putin uses. He's basically destroyed all alternative media, and even the few little alternatives that existed are being closed down, and Navalny's under house arrest. His blog has been shut down. It had 2 million followers. The internet has been an alternative to Putin's almost total control over information, but it looks like he's even moving against that.
Well, it seems like the role of the internet has changed radically over the course of the past 5 years in Russia. I think that originally, you know, 10 years ago, when, you know, 15 years ago now, actually, when Putin first came into power, he understood that the key to controlling public opinion in Russia was television. And so his, you know, basic moves were to take over, you know, independent television, which had sprung up in the 1990s, and make it into state television again. So that by the middle of the 2000s, all television had been brought to heel and was only producing the, you know, basically approved brand of news. But he also, you know, at that time, I think he was interested in projecting to the rest of the world a sense of, you know, Russia is still an open society, that there is still the possibility of alternative news sources. I think it was also important for, you know, Russian elites. No one in Russia, I think, wants to rush back into the arms of a completely controlled information environment. So there was, I think, always within that earlier strategy, the idea that you were going to leave some print sources as independent news sources. You were going to, you know, leave the internet pretty much alone, because I think that the Kremlin viewed the internet as a fairly marginal information source for most Russians, 10 years ago at least. And of course, right, this fig leaf effect. It was, I think, important for the Kremlin to be able to point to its independent media, which was marginal and which was not televised, and say to people who came and criticized it, well, look, we've got freedom of information. It's a free country. We've got free press. We've got freedom of speech. I think that all changed because, on the one hand, the role of the internet changed. By 2010, Russia, like everywhere else in the world, was being thoroughly penetrated by mobile devices, so that you didn't need to have a computer anymore to be hooked up to the social media to be connected to alternative news sources. And the, you know, mobile devices and, you know, Facebook in particular, other social networking platforms were really important in 2011 and 2012 when you had these, you know, mass protests of the urban, young, sort of middle class of Russia against the perceived corruption and jury rigging and, you know, ballot stuffing of the Putin administration. That, I think, was a wake-up call for the Kremlin, and they, I think, very quickly started to mobilize themselves to take control over the Internet. They created a new ministry and new legislation that allowed them to shut down very quickly any website which is deemed to be extremist, and they have extremely loose and broad definitions which can be applied in very arbitrary ways to determine who is disseminating extremist information and who isn't. That's what was used in order to shut down Navalny's site the last couple of days, that his sites are extremist because they support a reconciliatory and non-military relationship with Ukraine. And then, you know, I think there's also a sense of probably nervousness in the sort of Kremlin media control group with regard to the free press in general. So that they have actually been working pretty hard over the past couple of years to rein in the few print and popular internet sources which provide alternative media in Russia. That process accelerated really rapidly over the course of the last 2 months or so, so that the one independent televised source, which was a largely internet and sort of also it had some cable distribution, television channel TV Rain, very minor source, actually. I think it had 20 million viewers at its peak, 20 million subscribers. That has been cut off from cable for a couple of months now, so that it's, you know, purely internet distribution, basically, within Russia. And it's also been cut off, therefore, from its advertisers. It's about to go out of business. It was just announced this week that it's being chased out of its facilities, presumably under the pretext that it can't afford to pay them. It can't afford to pay them because its revenue stream has been cut off. And then the several prominent semi-alternative news sources have been taken over and had their administrations and journalist staffs purged over the course of the past. So it really has been a story of clampdown, which has reduced what little independent media there was to silence within Russia. There really isn't anywhere else to go for independent sources except offshore. Many of the sort of international sites are also blocked, though, because they're also deemed to be extremist.
And, of course, there is the one newspaper, Novaya Gazeta, that's partly owned by Gorbachev, that he hasn't really gone after, probably because of Gorbachev, I would imagine.
Yeah, that one is still running, and it's an important source. It's fairly minor in terms of its overall audience. It's
right.
The opposition newspaper of choice, largely read by the sort of urban opposition intelligentsia. But that's the other peculiar story about what's going on within Russia, is the extent to which sort of liberal creative intelligentsia, the educated urban elites, who 3 years ago were, you know, they weren't unified in their opposition to Putin. There was, I think, a fair degree of, you know, differences of opinion with regard to the goals and tactics of the protest movement. But there was, I think, a fair sense of, you know, unified upsurge of protest. I was in St. Petersburg and Moscow a lot that year. I was actually living in St. Petersburg. And you had the sense that, you know, the cities, the full elite, the educated classes were pretty much unified in revolt against Putin. There's nothing like that sense now. Really now, the vast majority of what you read in the media and also what you see on social media is united in support of Putin. There are opposition voices like Navalny's, but they are a really small minority. There's a sense that this issue, Crimea, has really been a wedge issue of incredible effectiveness for Putin, which has brought a lot of people who were opposed to him 3 years ago around into the sort of patriotic nationalist fold. It's pretty surprising to me, and there have been a number of very surprising, you know, people that I know personally, who, you know, I would never have expected them to come out in support of this. And it's a complicated story. It's partly because I think what was driving the opposition movement was the same sense of historical victimhood that is driving, you know, the same sort of base of emotion, right, that we have been crushed by our recent history. We are victims. 3 years ago, that rage was turned against Putin, rightfully so, as the major figure in charge of the victimization of the Russian people. But Putin has very effectively, through the image of an outside enemy, a corrupt West, an anti-Russian Western coalition, has managed to capitalize on that same sense of victimhood. And many people have bought the bait, decided that, in fact, the most important enemy is the external one, not the internal one. And they've banded together in that camp.
Well, we're not foreign to that kind of manipulation by our government here in the United States. We had, the Bush administration and the neoconservatives cooked up this whole war against Saddam Hussein, which, of course, the only winner in that war has been Iran, a complete catastrophe. But I recall at the time the entire press was on board, Hillary Clinton, John Kerry, all of our loyal opposition caved in and voted for this bogus war.
You're right. You're absolutely right. It's a similar situation. Although when you say all, I think there are shades of all that we have to talk about. There really is very, very, very little space for any kind of opposition activity, opposition voices in Russian society right now. There have been protests which have gathered together, you know, many people in Moscow. The estimates range from, you know, the absolutely bogus underestimates of the security forces. I think they said that there were like 10,000 people at the protest last Saturday in Moscow of the Kremlin line towards Crimea. And 70,000 was the estimate that I heard from some opposition sources. That is a serious opposition. But still, there's a sense in the sort of public media that I can read, even in talking with people, or reading email from them, that people are being careful, that they feel like they are under attack, that there is no room for dissent in this society. In Putin's speech on Tuesday, when he announced the annexation of the Crimea, he was using extraordinarily scary language with regard to not just the external enemies that the nation was facing, but to enemies within. He referred to the danger from fifth columnists within Russian society. So, and there have been, you know, various columns in the course of the week talking about and, you know, branding various liberal opposed figures as traitors. There's one that I read actually just this morning about Navalny. The society, I think, is teetering on the edge of a very sort of dangerous witch hunt mood with regard to its opposition. Let's hope that it doesn't go in that direction.
So you'll have a house of un-Russian activities, do you think?
Yeah, it could easily come to that.
I don't mean to make these analogies with the U.S. because there's clearly no comparison between the lack of personal freedom and
there are enlightening comparisons, of course.
Yeah,
and I think that it is important to remember that the Iraq escapade was a completely bogus war that was carried out for different reasons than the ones that were announced and that did not receive the, you know, correct airing in American society.
Sure.
But I think it's a slightly different situation than what we're facing here.
Oh, of course. But let's just, in the last couple of minutes, I wanted to talk to you about, I spoke yesterday with a scholar on Ukraine, Taras Kuzia.
Yeah, I listened to your interview with him yesterday.
Oh, you did? Oh. And he was saying, for example, that there is a free Russian press. It happens to be in Ukraine. So I want to get a sense of the near abroad, the people that Putin's appealing to, saying, you know, he wants to sort of, you know, not, I don't know whether he wants to thinks he can reconstitute the Soviet Union, but appealing to the Latvians, the Estonians, and Lithuanians and Ukrainians of Russians in those countries. But that was one of the things that he said yesterday, was that there's actually free press in Ukraine, and that's the only free Russian press. So which direction is it going in? Is Russia's propaganda going towards these people, these minorities that allegedly they need to rescue from fascists and anti-Semites, or the other way?
First of all, there's not really great data about the media consumption of the Russian language populations in Eastern Europe. And I would love to get my hands on that kind of a data set, because it would be very interesting to see who, first of all, does a Russian speaker living in Riga, Latvia, or in Kharkov, who do they read? Where do they go for their information? I suspect that they read both Russian sources and local Ukrainian sources. That seems to be the case for the people that I've worked with most closely in this part of the world, which is in Latvia. Latvia has about a 26% ethnic Russian population and about 10% more Russian speakers, people of various ethnicities who grew up speaking Russian. That's actually the largest, proportionally speaking, Russian and Russophone population of any post-Soviet state in Europe, more than in Ukraine. Ukraine is a very different kind of situation, though, because Ukrainian and Russian are very close languages, one to the other, and almost everyone in Ukraine is bilingual. There's also a street language, a dialect, maybe it's a separate language, which is halfway between these two languages. So it's a very different situation in that pretty much everyone in Ukraine can read both the Ukrainian press and the Russian press. It's hard to know exactly where they are getting their information. It's not just a question, though, of who you're getting information from, but whose narrative you're buying and how you filter that information. You know, what's going on with regard to Crimea, for instance, is as much a story about, you know, what facts you're paying heed to and you know, giving credence to, as it is a story about what narrative you're buying. Is it a narrative about the accident of fate that unjustly made Crimea a part of Ukraine and that rendered every Russian in the Crimea a victim of the collapse of the Soviet Union? They rightfully should have stayed in Russia, and somehow they went to sleep in one country and woke up in another, as Putin said once again on Tuesday. Or is Crimea a part of a vibrant multi-ethnic society that has been for years a part of the Ukrainian state and one which is, you know, legally and according to all norms of international law, a part of sovereign Ukrainian territory? These are very different kinds of stories. And the question is really not just, you know, which facts, because the facts can be the same, but whose narrative you're buying into. Russia, the Russian media are projecting extraordinarily loudly with extraordinary authority, the first story that I articulated. And the question is the other story being articulated loudly enough, clearly enough, and with enough sort of compelling force in whatever other sources of information people in Ukraine are having access to? That is an unequal fight, because Ukraine is, of course, a much freer information field than Russia. It does have a free Russian media, but it also has a very cacophonous Russian media. There are a lot of different voices in Ukraine, and there is right now, I think, a very shaky sense of unity with regard to the political spectrum in Ukraine, with regard to attitudes towards the new Ukrainian government. I think there's a lot of distrust for the newly formed Ukrainian government because it includes a lot of the former elites who were associated with past Ukrainian governments, which have not really served the Ukrainian people well. So it's an unequal battle between a very loud and very consistent, very well-controlled media machine with a very compelling story about national victimhood and just retribution versus another story which is somewhat confusing, based in legal niceties, which are in and of themselves even not the most compelling terms for many post-Soviet people. The sense of national boundaries and legal institutions is not incredibly, you know, well supported by the biographical experience of post-Soviet people in Eastern Europe.
Well, Kevin Platt, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure talking with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Kevin Platt, who's a professor of Slavic languages and literatures and graduate chair of the Comparative Literature Program at the University of Pennsylvania. His books include Terror and Greatness, Ivan and Peter as Russian Myths, and History in a Grotesque Key, Russian Literature and the Idea of Revolution. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about how Vermonters are pushing for a public bank in Vermont.
the world go around. The world go around, the world go around. Money makes the world go around. It makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck or a pound. A mark, a yen, a buck or a pound. Is all that makes the world go around. That clinking, clanking sound can make the world go round. Money, 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 money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Gwendolyn Hall-Smith, who's a co-founder of Vermonters for a New Economy and the new executive director of the Public Banking Institute. She's the author of The Keys to Sustainable Cities, Meeting Human Needs, Transforming Community Systems, and a new workbook, Taking Actions for Sustainability, The Earth Cat Guide to Community Development. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gwendolyn Hall-Smith.
Why, thank you.
And a Vermont senator, I imagine you're working with, has introduced a bill, Senator Paulina, in the Vermont Senate that would grant the Vermont Economic Development Authority a banking license to direct 10% of the Treasurer's bank deposits to VEDA for investment in Vermont. And I take it that this is popular at the grassroots, but the banking lobby have dominated the hearings so far before the Senate.
Yes, that is the way it's been unfolding. The banking lobby is a powerful voice in Montpelier, and we did manage to bring some of the activists and citizens who worked to get the question of public banking on the town meeting warning this year to the Senate the other day, and they testified in favor of a public bank and raised the issue of how the citizens' voices are heard in an arena where lobbyists have a clear advantage.
So in terms of what the Senate has heard so far, have they only heard for lobbyists, or have they heard at least from some proponents apart from Senator Paulina?
Yes, two proponents, Eric Esselstyn and Peg Elmer, both of whom were responsible for the successful town meeting votes in East Montpelier and Royalton, Vermont, were there the other day speaking in favor of a bank and speaking to the point of how the legislators hear from the citizens, because if all they ever listen to are the banking lobbyists and the bankers are opposed to this, and yet we have a groundswell of citizen support from around the state, how are citizens supposed to be able to get there during the working day with very little notice of hearings and express their views? Now, I believe that the Senate Finance Committee at this point has heard from a lot of people who've written to them and told them of their support for public banking, and of course, the evidence of 18 town meeting votes going forward with overwhelming support, I think, was also a really strong message to the legislature. So I'm hopeful that they're going to pass this legislation this year.
Well, clearly public banks at least have a model in North Dakota. And the Bank of North Dakota was founded about 100 years ago during the last Gilded Age as an alternative to the plutocratic control of banks. And this bank is quite thriving, provides, it's been a 100-year safe steward of state funds, providing loans at affordable rates and steering a lot of revenue towards public projects and infrastructure. And we don't have in the United States infrastructure banks like they do in all the other advanced democracies. So it's pretty extraordinary that you have this model in North Dakota, this thrive for 100 years, and yet very few other states have, except now for apparently Vermont, have picked up on it.
Right. Well, that isn't an accident, of course. Every time a state tries to do it, the banks get in the way and actually actively undermine it. Vermont did pass a state bank back in 1806, as it turns out. Maryland had one until the latter part of the 20th century, as I understand. And there are a number of countries worldwide that use this form of public financial management. Radical fringe economies like Germany and Brazil and India, Taiwan and Costa Rica have public banks as one of their main sources of public finance. So, and those are some of the most successful Western economies in the world. It's hard to look at the whole situation and say that this is a foolhardy venture. It's a fairly rational venture, especially in an era of increasingly risky investments in the larger banks, since the crash of 2008 and the changes in the banking world that actually make depositors the same as investors in banks, coming after the derivatives holders and the repurchase agreements holders in the case of a bank failure. You know, depositors these days in banks are the same as uninsured creditors or unsecured creditors. It's not that good a picture. And the fact that our state's deposits, of which are average $350 million a day, are secured, allegedly, from a letter of credit from the U.S. Federal Home Loan Bank, means that we're essentially backing our state deposits with the full faith and credit of the banking system. And I just don't think that's as wise, frankly, as the full faith and credit of the citizens in the state of Vermont.
Again, I'm speaking with Gwendolyn Hall-Smith, who's a co-founder of Vermonters for a New Economy and the new executive director of the Public Banking Institute. She's the author of The Keys to Sustainable Cities, Meeting Human Needs, Transforming Community Systems, and a new workbook, Taking Action for Sustainability, The Earth Cat Guide to Community Development. Well, I've spoken with Senator Bernie Sanders a few times about this issue, particularly about the post office. He's trying to save the post office along with Senator Elizabeth Warren. And one of the ways to revive the post office, which is being deliberately bankrupted by the Congress, they have suggested restoring post office banking, which I think operated throughout the country up until about the 1960s. And of course, post office banks are huge in Japan, Germany, China, and South Korea. And the Japan Post Office Bank is ranked as one of the world's largest financial institutions based on its assets. So there are obviously efforts here to find alternatives to the big banks and to Wall Street. What's your sense of going forward, what it's going to require, given the apparent power of the banking lobby?
Well, I think the kind of thing you're doing right now, educating people about the alternatives and helping people understand that this isn't the only way to go. Post office banks would be a wonderful thing because, especially in Vermont, where we have a small post office in every little town in the state, but we don't actually have banks in every town in the state. So it would give access to those type of services to a lot of the people in Vermont who currently don't even have access to bank accounts or pay very high rates for their access to banking services. I think the fact that the post office could probably make a profit from it will also help save the post office, which for Vermont is an important issue because our post offices are more than places that deliver our mail. They're the center of a lot of our community lives because we don't actually have a lot of big cities in Vermont. Sometimes the post office and the town hall and the church are the only thing in town, and without the post office there, we'll really suffer a loss of our rural character. So I applaud Bernie Sanders for taking that on, and I think that educating people and educating the public and educating the Congress and educating all the legislators about the alternatives is really important because it isn't the only way to go. So banks aren't the only way that we have to manage public finance and our credit accounts and checking accounts. We really need to start looking at money as more of a public utility and less of a privately owned commodity, because it is so essential to our economic health. Most people don't understand how it works and don't understand how the profits accrue within the system to work against the better interest of the vast majority of us. And yet, really, all it's needed for is as a means of exchange, a store of value, a unit of account, standard functions of money. We really need to look at how to make those functions more democratic and more at the service of the vast majority of our citizens rather than the few. Wealthy ones.
So
tend to be the shareholders of the banks.
So Gwendolyn Hall-Smith, again, the co-founder of Vermonters for a New Economy and the new executive director of the Public Banking Institute. Specifically in terms of this proposal in Vermont to create a public bank, you're using an existing vehicle, I guess, the Vermont Economic Development Authority. That's a nonprofit agency that makes loans. You want to turn that into a bank and then and put 10% of the state's funds in it, right?
Correct. And it's actually a little more than a nonprofit agency. It's an arm of the state, an instrumentality of the state. The state established it. The state governs it. It's just got a firewall between the state political authorities and the banking services that it offers. which is an important concept for people that criticize the whole enterprise by saying, oh, we don't want government running a bank, and how are politics going to interfere with the operation of the bank? Because even in North Dakota, there's a very strong firewall between politics and banking, as there should be. We don't want loans going to cronies of political leaders, et cetera. You want it to be done on a rational basis that's based on what's good for the economy in the state of Vermont. So VITA already does the riskiest part of running a public bank. They already do the lending. In fact, they do the lending to the groups and enterprises that the bankers don't necessarily want to lend to because they're higher risk loans. So VITA already does even more risky lending than the banks do. And establishing VITA with a banking license and giving it the ability to work in partnership with the state chartered banks and credit unions to make more credit available to businesses in Vermont and to municipalities in Vermont and to homeowners in Vermont that need access to credit and access to lending services isn't actually taking on more risks than we already have. The kind of risks that banks manage, you know, which are typically known as liquidity risks, right, where you need the money that you have in the account to pay the bills, and meanwhile you're lending it out for the long-term needs of a particular enterprise or municipality, is something that banks deal with all the time. That's why we feel it's important for VITA to have a banking license, so they have the tools available to them that banks have available, like a window at the Federal Reserve, access to interbank overnight lending, et cetera, to help manage the risks that bankers are all very familiar with. You know, liquidity risk, default risk, interest rate risk, all of those things are something that all, the banking sector deals with day in and day out.
Well, and of course they get that.
Sometimes not.
Right. But all the time they get their money from the Fed at an incredibly low interest rate, right?
Right. So that would give the public sector the same access to that free money, essentially, which how is that wrong for our infrastructure and for our economic development projects?
Well, that's always struck me as being extraordinary, how the banks, you know, get money at such a low interest rate and then charge it back, you know, 18 to 20% on credit cards, et cetera, getting it about a 1 or 2%. And they've been doing this has been going on for decades. So
it's a good business model if you can get it. You know, make money out of nothing and charge other people to use it.
Right.
Great business model. And all we're trying to do is mobilize that business model for the public benefit.
So I take it, though, when the public hear these kind of arguments, as presumably our listeners here today are hearing, they get it. I mean, it's pretty obvious, isn't it?
Yeah, that's why it passed town meeting vote in Vermont. People heard the argument, got it, said, yeah, that makes sense. Vermonters have a wealth of common sense, and this is just plain old common sense. Let's not put our money, our taxpayers' money, into banks that are investing it elsewhere and then borrow it back for our investments here. We'll just lend ourselves our own money, thank you very much, and make our investments here ourselves. That's really the essence of public banking. Right now, with the state deposits going primarily to TD Bank North, that means that Vermonters' taxpayer dollars are helping invest in the XL pipeline up in Canada, which is another thing that a lot of Vermonters are opposed to. And meanwhile, we've set an ambitious state goal of becoming 80% dependent on renewables by 2030. That's a $23 billion price tag that we yet don't understand how to pay for.
So in other words, people's own political values, the banks that they're forced to make their deposits in because of the lack of choice and the lack of a public alternative, are making investments in using their depositors' money to make investments that are against the wishes and values of these very same depositors.
Exactly right. Exactly right. And meanwhile, we're short of money to invest in the renewable alternatives that Vermont so badly wants. So we could take the same money and make the same business decisions around energy lending, which in North Dakota has proven to be very smart, only lend it for energy projects in Vermont that are renewable that can help us be more self-reliant over the next several years instead of continuing to underwrite the fossil fuel industry, which is not only catastrophic from an environmental point of view, but also from a risk point of view. We really need to get out of fossil fuels. Everybody knows that. So why are we continuing to invest in them long term as if they were a smart thing to do with our money? It's really not.
So just
there's also a fairly strong divestment movement in Vermont to try and get the state treasurer to take our pension funds and our other long-term investments out of fossil fuels because of the risks associated with that. And these two movements really do sort of complement each other.
Just in closing, Gwendolyn Hall-Smith, I take it there are other states in this country that are doing what you're doing in Vermont that are looking into public banking, and there are a number of proposals in play, I take it. How are they doing in other states relative to how you're doing in Vermont?
Well, currently Ellen Brown is running for treasurer in California on a public banking platform, so that's going to provide some visibility to the movement there. As I understand, in California, they're looking at it on a city and a county level. The city of San Francisco and Sonoma are working on public banking initiatives. And other states like Maine and Arizona and New Mexico, Rhode Island are all also looking at public banks. And I just got back, as I said, from Michigan. I was in Detroit for several days because the cities there are looking very favorably at public banking as an alternative to the kind of situation they've been put in by the banks with the lending that was done to them back in the heyday of credit default swaps and interest rate swaps that have systematically bankrupted many cities in Michigan. So we're looking to hold our national conference coming up in October in Michigan as a way of helping the cities there that are under emergency management and otherwise struggling to help revive their economies understand the alternatives that are available to them as we move forward with public banking initiatives.
Well, Gwendolyn Hall-Smith, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Sure. Well, thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Gwendolyn Hall-Smith, who's the co-founder of Vermonters for a New Economy and the new executive director of the Public Banking Institute. She is the author of The Keys to Sustainable Cities, Meeting Human Needs, Transforming Community Systems, and a new workbook, Taking Action for Sustainability, The EarthCat Guide to Community Development. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about how the CEO of Time Warner Cable has rewarded himself an $80 million golden parachute for losing a job he only held for 3 months.
Outside the patient millions, put them into power. Expect a little more back for their taxes. Like school books, bedding, hospitals, and peace in our bloody time. All they get is old men grinding.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is John Simpson, a veteran journalist and consumer rights advocate with Consumer Watchdog, a nonpartisan, nonprofit public interest group dedicated to providing an effective voice for taxpayers and consumers in an era when special interests and media monopolies dominate public discourse, government, and politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Simpson.
Pleasure to be with you.
And this Time Warner Comcast merger, which has been getting a lot of negative press, at least from people I talk to, and it's so flagrantly subject to antitrust, one wonders whether or not it can go forward, but apparently it is. And now we've just learned that the CEO of Time Warner Cable, Rob Marcus, its president and chief operating officer, who's only been on the job 3 months, is getting a $80 million golden parachute for essentially negotiating a deal that rewards himself.
That certainly seems to be what it sounds like, and some of his colleagues are getting whopping golden parachute amounts as well. Chief Financial Officer, I think, is getting $27 million, and the Chief Technology Officer gets $16.3. And this whole deal is not about improving things for consumers. It is not in the public interest. It probably violates antitrust law. I'm quite hopeful that the Justice Department will intervene and block it.
Well, this is not the first time that corporate America has rewarded itself for negotiating buyouts. The CEO of Gillette, in 2006, he pocketed $185 million after Gillette was acquired by Procter & Gamble in a deal that he helped bring about. So by that comparison, Rob Marcus, the CEO of Time Warner Cable, is getting off. He's a neophyte. But, of course, he's only been on the job for 3 months. That's the part of it that I find extraordinary. Yeah, where do you find a job that you can get $80 million for 3 months' pay?
I
on top of the pay that he already got, by the way. So
yeah, well, you know, the whole CEO salary structure in this country is out of whack. I mean, back in the 60s or so, I mean, the average CEO made maybe 40 times the average salary of the average worker, and now it's up around 400 times the average worker. There's just no justification whatsoever for the high rates of chief executive pay that we're doing in the United States. And this golden parachute stuff is just gotten completely out of hand. But again, the thing that I'm a little optimistic about here is again, the Justice Department has got to look at the deal on strictly an antitrust grounds. And there are all sorts of antitrust reasons that I think may hold it. But beyond that, the FCC has to decide whether it's in the public interest. And it's interesting to note that a number of the state attorneys general have joined the Justice Department and been looking at it for antitrust problems. California's Attorney General Kamala Harris is one of those who's part of that group, as is the Attorney General from Connecticut and some other states as well. So this is not yet by any means a done deal.
Well, just in terms of CEO compensation, apparently the Dodd-Frank financial reform law gave the SEC a little bit more leeway to make it harder for executives to leave companies with these massive golden parachutes. But in terms of what law is restraining this deal? I mean, what antitrust laws are we talking about here?
Well, you're talking about whether they've got a monopoly of two issues. One would be a monopoly over the cable TV aspect of things, and they like to say they don't compete in any of the markets, which is kind of a bogus thing because all of cable television is nothing but a series of local monopolies. So you have to look at the national market and what share the merged companies would have of that, and it gets into a threshold where it starts to raise very serious antitrust issues. The other aspect of it is with broadband, because now both of these companies are major broadband suppliers, and that would also probably be even a higher rate of concentration of Internet broadband access. So those are two areas where they're quite likely running into the issues with antitrust monopoly situation. Beyond that, Comcast is, you know, tied up now with Universal, which is a content provider. So you get the situation where you have a content provider who is also controlling the means of distribution, which has some very interesting potential antitrust issues, or certainly issues of being not necessarily a violation of being antitrust law, but not being in the public interest because other content providers would not be able to have equal access to for their content to get to consumers. So those are issues that I think are very troublesome ones that as I say, I'm optimistic the regulatory authorities will take a hard look at.
Again, I'm speaking with John Simpson, a veteran journalist and consumer rights advocate with Consumer Watchdog, a nonpartisan, nonprofit public interest group dedicated to providing an effective voice for taxpayers and consumers in an era when special interests and media monopolies dominate public discourse, government, and politics. So do we know whether this CEO of Time Warner, Rob Marcus, who's getting $80 million after just being in a golden parachute, after just being on the job for 3 months, I wonder if he was there when they had their spat with CBS, Time Warner, where they showed so total arrogant disregard for their customers and consumers by just having this public fight where you couldn't get CBS as a Time Warner subscriber. And, you know, I had to switch cable companies at the time. A lot of people did, but it wasn't particularly convenient, but they didn't care. I mean, it was more important to them to go to the mat with each other like these sort of hard-nosed fraternity boys carrying on in their infantile way. But what I found so objectionable about it was the arrogant attitude that they had, that we consumers are just collateral damage.
Absolutely. And as I recall, he was there not as CEO, but I believe he was in another key executive role, but chief operating officer, perhaps.
Oh, I see. So he got a promotion then, right?
Yeah, he played a role in all of that.
Right. Where do you find jobs like this, John Simpson? I mean, let me talk. I know you've been.
Well, let me put it this way: if you could find a job like this, would you take it? I think I would. I'd like to think that I wouldn't.
Well, that's true, but I'm being ironic. I mean, I think morally the whole thing is objectionable, but it's, you know, the point is that we live in a universe now where you don't have to, in corporate America, you don't have to perform. You just get rewarded no matter what.
Well, if you're the top guy.
Yeah, and it's the same, for example, you know, with like the people who are soaking the treasury, the military-industrial complex. You can build a plane like the F-35 that doesn't work. It's worse than the planes that performs much more inferior to the planes it's replacing, and yet nobody can stop it, you know. So the question now is whether they can stop this Time Warner Comcast merger, given the informational power that Time Warner and Comcast have, and also their lobbying muscle. So what's your sense about pushback from the grassroots on this?
Well, it's going to have to be pushed back from the grassroots, because it's certainly the case that Comcast is out in with all of the resources that its millions of dollars for lobbying can buy. They've also put a lot of money into some. They've had a habit of financing various kinds of usually good public interest groups, and who they're now trying to get to rally for their support. And I think we're going to have to push back very hard and try to make the case that it's just not serving the customers and serving the public interest. And again, I'm encouraged by the fact that the state attorneys general are taking up the case, and it's not just the U.S. Justice Department. That's very important.
Well, my understanding, and I know you've been working against Google's monopoly power, which is pretty obvious. And one of the things, though, that I find ironic about this situation is that the merger of Time Warner and Comcast, both of them deliver inferior service than any competitors in the rest of the world. In France, you get about 10 times the speed on your internet for a quarter of the price that you pay here. And it's you get like 1,000 times the speed in South Korea and Japan, and these people don't care. I mean, the guy at Verizon who put in Fios, the fiber optic high speed internet, they fired him. Wall Street fired him because he was spending too much money without the quick returns. And now, of course, ironically, the Fios has turned out to be their biggest revenue generator. Mm-hmm. But that just shows you the mindset of these short-term corporate thinking. But the point I'm trying to make here is that my understanding is that Google is laying fiber optics as an alternative to these sclerotic monopolies that deliver you lousy, worse and worse service for more and more money and don't give a damn about the consumer.
I think that is indeed why Google is putting down some of its own fiber optic network, and they're hoping to provide some competition. And I'm a longtime critic of Google for a lot of reasons. I think that this is a case where they're actually doing something that is very beneficial for the Internet. The only concern one might have about it is, though, of course, if they are an ISP, that means that they get access to everything that goes on over that network, which is different than what they would have now if they only get information through the services that they're providing. So there might be some questions about how they would use the information that's traveling on their networks, whether they'd go into deep packet inspection and some of those kinds of things. But the notion that they're not happy with the quality of broadband service and they're trying to make it better by providing some competition is probably a good thing.
So the alternative, I mean, the opposite of what you just was describing is, for example, the state of Chattanooga, Tennessee, they've laid down fiber as a utility. And I believe the city of Santa Monica, where you are, has done the same thing. And it's attracting business like crazy because, you know, businesses, particularly creative businesses, it's a huge boon to have, you know, high-speed internet, and it's proved to be an enormous job creator for all this nonsense they talk about job creators, and yet these monopolies deny that possibility because they sit on this lousy service they have. They don't want to invest a dime into improving it. So you have examples like the city of Chattanooga, but every time a city or a state tries to have an alternative to these monopolies like Verizon, Comcast, and Time Warner, they get sued.
They pass laws to block it. Pennsylvania was trying to do some essentially publicly owned, at the time I think they were Wi-Fi networks, and they got a law passed that wouldn't let them do it, they being the providers.
So what, I mean, how, just because they can buy the legislators and somehow the grassroots people just can't make enough noise, or the point is, if you make a lot of noise, who the hell's going to cover it if these media companies are a part of the problem?
Well, it's certainly a tough issue. I mean, I think we need to have folks like you out there spreading the word, and people like me raising a little hell now and then and trying to keep the heat on the lawmakers, and we sometimes win a battle or so.
Well, we're going to have to win a few more.
I agree with that.
I thank you for joining us here today, John.
Been a pleasure to talk with you.
Again, I've been speaking with John Simpson, who's a veteran journalist and consumer rights advocate with Consumer Watchdog, a nonpartisan, nonprofit public interest group dedicated to providing an effective voice for taxpayers and consumers in an era when special interests and media monopolies dominate public discourse, government, and politics. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared by